Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Catherine Richard, filling in for Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, we're talking about the age that women have children and what that means for moms and children in the long run. When my husband and I started thinking about having kids, I was 31. We weighed lots of factors. Were we making enough money to support a child? Did we have enough space? Were we ready to embrace the fact that we would literally never sleep a full 8 hours again? But a big part of the calculation was whether I felt comfortable in my career to add a baby to the picture. And as it turns out, weighing these factors makes me just another data point. A recent reporting project by the New York Times showed that the age women have kids plays a big role in their success in life and the success of their children's lives. Women who wait longer are more likely to be educated, have established careers, and have years of earning power to pay for things like tutoring or music lessons. What we know is that the age when women give birth is part of a widening equity gap in the United States. So I want to know, if you're a mother or considering becoming one, how important is timing? Did you want to save up or hit a career milestone before having your first baby? Or were those factors unimportant to you? You can call me at 651-227-6000 or toll free at 800-242-2828. You can also reach me on Twitter by tweeting at Kat Richert. That's CatRichert. Joining me this hour to help answer some of these questions are Elise Gould. She is a senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute. She joins us today from Washington, D.C. Welcome, Elise.
Good morning.
We also have Rhonda Vanche-Sharp. She's the president and founder of WISER, Women's Institute for Science, Equity, and Race. She's joining us from Mechanicsville, Virginia. Thank you for joining us, Rhonda.
Good morning.
So I want to start with this question of education. What do we know about how a woman's level of education influences when she decides to have kids? And why does it play such an important role? Elise, I'm going to start with you.
Yeah, I think one of the things to start with is that we know that the age that women are having children for all different groups of people has increased. So their teenage pregnancy is down. Women with lower levels of education and with higher levels of education are having children later than they have, at previous parts in U.S. history. You know, even the last 10, 20 years, we're seeing those ages rise. But what you do see from the study that the New York Times put out is that women with higher levels of education are more likely to delay having children. And so on average, they're having children about 10 years later than women with lower levels of education. So those with college degrees or grad school may look to finish those degrees and get established in their careers before they're making those parenthood decisions, whereas some women who didn't finish college or haven't gone on yet at that point in their careers are having children earlier.
So one thing that I thought was really interesting about this study is that while it seems pretty intuitive that couples, women, men would consider things like education, socioeconomics, and geography before they have a baby, there's something about geography that also influences this decision. And it seems to have something to do with politics, whether the region where the mom lives is conservative or liberal. What kind of role do we see that playing, Rhonda? Can you address that question?
I will do my very best to address that. I think one of the things, and I'm going to speak from more from the lens of thinking about Black women and women of color, is in particular with Black families, we know that since the first time since 1960s, you have more Blacks in the South, right? So if you're going to have more folks moving to the South, and we also know in the South that you're having some changes in with respect to politics. Some of the states that used to be red are now becoming more blue, or what we think about as being purple. I think when we talk about women of color, I'm not sure the role of that politics plays, because in many instances, again, with Black women, the role of marriage and childbirth hasn't necessarily played as big a factor as with other women. So I'm not sure how much politics is actually influencing that, and particularly for Black women, as it may be for white women, right, where this is more of how society may view you as a single mother, how society is changing expectations about your career versus being a stay-at-home mom. Again, if we sort of think about some of the more recent movies, so Free State of Jones, thinking about, I believe it is Mutt Hole, you see some relationships between Black women being caretakers for white women in their families. So a lot of the conversations that we're having about changes in cultural and social issues are really changes for white women, not necessarily women of color.
At least any thoughts on that? Any thoughts on how values or geography would influence the decision about when to have kids?
Yeah, I think that Rhonda brings up some really great points. You know, one of the things that people often talk about is the rise in women's labor force participation in this country. And, you know, the fact is that Black women have been working all along to support their families. And so some of the differences that I think we'll be talking about later in the show, is important to remember that this is a dynamic group that represents, you know, many different people with different experiences. I think one thing when you talk about politics, one thing I might say is that there seems to be an increase of people that are more similar politically, socially, demographically, education-wise, sort of hanging together more. You see that on social media. You see that geographically. And so that will influence people's decisions. So it may not just be what they're deciding in their family, whether or not they have a spouse, what their income is. Also, some of those factors that are around them are going to influence the decision that they make in terms of whether or not to have children or when to have children.
So we had Mike on Twitter write us to say that he doesn't have any kids, but they recently had this discussion on when. He said, we bought a house. We just got married. Finances were a big decision. We want our savings accounts back in order and everything settled before we have kids. And we're also going to take a call now from Kendall in Rosemont. Kendall, what's been your experience with this?
Well, my husband and I waited a significant period of time to have children. We got married late, and we made the decision once our finances were set. It was a huge decision factor because we wanted to be able to provide for our children.
Right. So, Elise, can you talk about that a little bit more? I mean, what implications would a decision like that have for her children down the road? And also, I should just point out that a decision like that is, for some people, a decision of privilege, right? They have the opportunity to make a choice here. Some women are not faced with that opportunity.
Right, right. And also the opportunity to use fertility treatments and be able to make those kinds of decisions and make those investments later. Obviously, women are increasingly able to have children later, but not everyone has those opportunities. So I think that, you know, when you do wait, you're talking about increasing a little bit of that divide that you have between lower and moderate income women and higher income women that may be able to wait and be able to make those investments. And so you see these disparities between low-income children and higher-income children being perpetuated by this waiting for some and less waiting for others, so that the fact of how well your parents are doing is a huge influence on how well you're going to do as a kid growing up, the opportunities you have, the ability to, as you said, to take those piano lessons, the ability for your parents to make those investments, because we have decided to a certain extent as a society that we are not going to put that money into those enrichment programs for all kids in this country. We could make a different decision, and we could try to reduce those inequalities that we see in this country by making those investments in affordable and high-quality child care for all kids. And so you could actually reduce some of those disparities significantly that way.
Yeah. I want to take a call now from Megan in Rochester, who said she had a daughter when she was young. Megan, what's been your experience?
Hello?
Megan, are you there?
I'm here, yes. Hi, sorry.
Hi. No, that's okay. You tell us that you had a daughter when you were young. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so I had my daughter when I was young. I was 23 years old, and she was unplanned. And it it kind of created this sense of urgency for me to create, to educate myself and to teach her how to educate herself, and then be able to provide those things to her in the future. And I think, like people were saying before, that, you know, different incomes and different economic levels, if you want to say that, give them a little bit more opportunity to provide that stuff. And at that time, I was in poverty. Like, I didn't have any money, and I was working at a nursing home. And so when I found out I was pregnant, I said, oh my goodness, I'm going to have to figure out how to pay for this child, essentially. And it was a kind of an eye opener for me. Recently, I actually brought my daughter with me to a session for an exam, and she sat there with me, and she sat there with my whole class, and she saw us sitting there and listening to our teacher and educating ourselves on things that were important to us. And so I think that's extremely important as well, without being financially stable at the beginning of her life. So,
right. So your daughter is seeing you work now very hard to get to where you want to be in your career.
Right. And I mean, her dad, he's deployed right now. And I mean, it's just me and her for a while. And we're not married. So she kind of sees that as well. She sees us working together. She sees him working hard and me working hard, even though we're not married. And so I think that's extremely important for children to see, and maybe create some success for them in the future as well.
Yeah. So I want to get back to this question of race, because the New York Times actually didn't really address this question, and I think it's an important one. Rhonda, do we know if any of these statistics about older moms cut across racial lines as well? Or if you're a woman of color, are you making a totally different set of decisions?
I think that it does cut across. So when I got up this morning, one of the things I did was I did a quick run looking at the data by race, not ethnicity. And what I am finding is, or what the data show, is the biggest increase in terms of thinking about age at which a mother's first child is born, the largest change has been with Chinese and Japanese women. And we also know that this is a group that tends to invest heavily in education. Not seeing as large of a jump for Black women, again, independent of education, and from 1960 to roughly about 2017, that white women have increased the age at which they're having their first child by about 2 years. I think that in addition to this conversation about race is something that you mentioned earlier, and that is privilege. And that this conversation about what parents want to provide for their children, and the New York Times article, I think, is coming from a privileged point of view, right? That before you can think about if you can provide tutoring services, what extracurriculars you can have, what college prep, you've got to be able to put a roof over your child's head, you know, pay provide the basic necessities. So I thought it was very interesting that the article jumped to the privileged view and not just the basic view. So how different would this article have been if we were having a conversation about being able to just provide the basics and then building on that? And Elise, you know, talked about that just a little bit. But I don't think that we're having enough conversation, independent of the racial conversation, that this is definitely from a privileged view.
Yeah, say more about that. I mean, how do you think the conversation would be different if we were talking about just the basics?
So I think that if you were talking about just the basics, you would find that, as your caller indicated, right, that she thought about, I mean, once she found out she was pregnant, she was like, oh my goodness, I've got to be able to provide the basics for my child. Now how can I do that? Right? So she began to make very different decisions, as opposed to, I am going to wait until I can provide the privileged view for my child to have kids. So I think that what often seems to be portrayed is that folks who are in lower SES status are somehow irresponsible in their decision to have children, as opposed to folks who are at higher SES, right? Because the conversation is about how much money do we have, what can we provide, how big is our home. So I think if the conversation changed from that perspective, that maybe respect isn't the correct word, but we'd have a different level of respect for parents at low SES. I also think that the data in terms of education is going to become more and more tricky as more women are seeking to increase their education after they have their children. It may be trickier to figure out whether or not women are actually having their children before they're educated or if they're making the decision after to have their children. I think especially when we're talking about advanced degrees, just in terms of the number of women who are taking advantage of for-profit institutions, and you can see this in the ways that they are advertising.
Yeah, I just want to read a comment from a caller, Anya in Bloomington. She said, my daughter was a surprise while I was in medical school. She said she's a single mom currently in the medical field where she's helping people plan. And she said, it's very interesting. Having a child made me want to work even harder. And I think that sort of resonates with our caller from Rochester as well. So I want to pivot a little bit and talk some about childcare in general, and how this burden still falls most heavily on women, but that men are starting to take more of a role in that work. And I'm wondering if the expectation that more of that responsibility will be shared is a factor in all of this and how that might impact the success of our children going forward. Elise, can you address that?
Sure. Certainly there is a lot of talk about men taking on more responsibilities. I don't know how that exactly is playing out. You know, in home to home, obviously there's a lot of variation in what's going on there. But the fact is, when you look at the data, after the birth of a child, women are less likely to work and they work fewer hours than men. So actually men who have children work more likely to work and work more hours. And so you see this division that happens where women are taking on more of the caregiving responsibilities. And that happens actually even without kids. If you look at married couples and the time that women are spending doing household activities, they are still doing more of that, even if both she and her husband are working. And so you see that even exacerbated more when they have children in the household. And so you see women taking a step back from the labor market, and that lower labor force participation is often because they simply they don't have affordable child care. They don't have paid parental leave. And so there are many policies that could be in place to help women be able to stay in the labor market. But that exacerbates what we see in terms of the gender pay gap in society at large.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that a little bit more later on. But first, I want to hear more from my audience. I want to know, did you wait to have kids? And why did you wait? Are you choosing not to have kids at all? And I'm also wondering if finances have played a role in having fewer children or no children at all. You can call in at 651-227-6000, or you can reach me on Twitter by tweeting at Kat Richert. That's CatRichert. So one thing that surprised me in all of this is that more women are choosing to become mothers, but they're just doing it later in life. What do we know about this, and what does this mean for our economy? Is it good for women, economically speaking, to have women having children later in life? Elise, go ahead.
I'm not sure exactly the role of them waiting longer and what that means for the economy. You know, I think more about women taking time out of the labor force and what that means for the economy. We see, if we look at the U.S. economy as a whole, we have seen for, 30, 40 years up until 2000, about 2000, you see women increasing their participation in the labor force. They're getting more educated. They're having more opportunities to expand into occupations that they hadn't had before. But then what you see over the last about 15, 20 years, you see a decline in that labor force participation. Again, I'm talking about averages. If experiences are different for women of different races, of different education groups. But in general, you're seeing this softening of participation in the labor force. That didn't happen in some of our peer countries. Think countries like Canada, Japan, Germany. They didn't see that softening in labor force participation. And many policy analysts attribute that to the fact that those countries have policies that support parents in a way that the United States does not. So things like paid parental leave, being able to take time out when your kids are young, being able to have affordable childcare, universal pre-K, many policies that would support parents and allow women to work. So not having those women across the education spectrum, right, who have invested in their education, have become experts in their field, not being in the labor force, that can be a drag on the economy as well.
Yeah, and we had a caller call in who said that they think a paid family leave policy would help close that gender wage gap for women. Rhonda, can you address that a little bit more? How important are these paid leaves in terms of supporting women through pregnancy and parenting?
Again, I'm going to speak for how I think about this for Black women.
Sure.
Major. Elise's has colleagues, Valerie Wilson, and I think Janelle Gims has moved on, but they have some work talking about the hours at which women work, and in that you find that Black women work more hours, earn less, even when they're mothers. So even this notion of providing more hours for childcare in addition to working. So if you have paid parental leave, and we know, again, Black women are less likely to be married than in comparison to other groups with respect to childbirth, having paid parental leave will provide them an opportunity to actually do some bonding before they actually come back to work, right? So I think, again, a lot of this conversation about paid parental leave, I think the question is, whose lens are we talking about, right? Who are going to be the major benefactors of this? The Center for American Progress just did a study looking at D.C. and universal pre-K. And even in that study, finding that the largest increase for labor force participation was white women.
Right. So,
I think in many instances, things like parental leave are going to be beneficial for all women. The question is, who is it going to matter more for? And I think who will be in a situation to be able to take more advantage of that, right? Because if you're a two-parent household and you're talking about taking leave,
right,
that's a little different, or maybe not. Maybe it will be more beneficial for women who are in a single-parent household. I don't think that these are the kind of studies that we're doing, and we're definitely not doing them from a race ethnicity lens, right? It is generally women as a whole.
Right, and I should point out, too, that paid leave is more likely to be given to women who are on, like, a salary, right? Not on an hourly position. I mean, I think that that's a factor as well. How many women are working hourly jobs that are, you know, you work 5 hours this day, you work 10 the next day kind of thing, versus how many women are working 9 to 5 on a salary, right? I mean, I'm sure that factors into this as
well. Absolutely. Job autonomy, the status of your occupation, I think you're absolutely right, matters. And we know, again, that for women of color, and not necessarily for white women and for Asian women, but for Black and Hispanic and Native American women, there's more of a likelihood to be in jobs that provide less autonomy, where you are hourly as opposed to being salaried in terms of coming into work, or even just having jobs that are going to give you reasonable benefits, or be a full-time worker, right? Because the other thing you can have is that you're a part-time worker, and so even if there is parental leave, you may not qualify for it.
I'm Catherine Richard, filling in for Carrie Miller, and this is NPR News. If you're just joining the conversation, we've been talking about how the age a woman decides to have kids is contributing to a growing equity gap in the United States. We have Elise Gould. She's a senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute. She joins us from Washington. And we have Rhonda Vanche Sharp. She is the founder and president of WISER. That stands for Women's Institute for Science, Equity, and Race. And she's joining us from Mechanicsville, Virginia. So I actually want to start this part of the conversation with a call from Carrie in Lakeville. Carrie, tell us about your experience having kids.
Well, I definitely am passionate about being an older mother. Since I had my first baby at 38, my second at 40, I can speak a little bit about the benefits and also some of the drawbacks of it. I don't think I'd be as effective or as good of a mom if I would have become a mom earlier in life. That's just my own experience. I know that, you know, there's a lot of proponents for having kids early when you have more energy, and certainly just our can keep up with your kids. But having kids, I find, you know, my emotional maturity level, when you're a little bit more advanced in age, more worldly experience. I spent my 20s and 30s traveling around and doing the things I wanted to do and really experiencing all of the really rich and wonderful things that life had to offer. When my husband and I decided to start trying, we had some fertility problems for quite a few years. So dealt with recurrent losses and eventually ended up, you know, having our first at 38. So, but also being a little bit older, then you deal with the things that, you know, that advanced age brings, such as health issues, recovering from childbirth and things like that. But, you know, this side of the coin, I don't have any regrets about how I did it.
Yeah. So you bring up something important, which is that with advanced age, you also encounter some fertility issues. And I'm wondering from both of our guests here, how we're seeing women have children later in life, but how much is technology influencing that decision? Does it help women sort of feel safer or more confident that they can wait till later to have children? Elise?
Well, I think one of the reasons why we are seeing more waiting and fewer teenage pregnancies is because of access to birth control. So there's that side of the coin as well. Access to family planning resources is really important for people to make the decisions that they want to make when they have choices to make those. I think that there's no question as well that we've made advances in fertility treatments, and whether or not they work for everybody, you know, is certainly not always the case. However, I think that people see those as options and see that they can start later, and that may lead to them waiting.
Right.
I agree with Elise, and I think the conversation around Serena Williams and Michelle Obama about both Serena on the other side with respect to challenges she had after birth and the pulmonary embolism, and Michelle Obama talking about the use of IVF to conceive is definitely, I think, bringing the issues around reproductive justice and technology and delaying more to the forefront.
Right. So I think I hear you both saying that while technology is important, it's also important to have access to birth control early on so you can delay, you know, until you're more financially secure. And that's not something that everyone has access to. I mean, Rhonda, what are some of the challenges there for women just accessing birth control?
You know, I don't know. I made the choice to be sterilized. And I know that choice was met with a great deal of resistance from women who saw me as being selfish, and the fact that I made that decision prior to being 30, which apparently in many states is a no-no to not have children and to decide to be sterilized before you are 30 is problematic. So I don't know what the challenges are with respect to getting birth control. I know there is some data that suggests that having Title IX require ACA to be more forthcoming or responsible with respect for birth control for women as they think about Viagra and other ED drugs for men probably matters. But in terms of specifics, I'm not sure. I suspect that you tie it to healthcare and you tie it to economics, and women who are at the bottom are in the same situation, very little access, and couple that with challenges to Planned Parenthood makes it difficult. But specific numbers, I don't know.
Okay. I just want to read a few of the calls that have come in while we've been talking. Shannon in Osseo said, my decision was for my career. Being a Black woman, everyone in my family waited until later. I had my first child at 38, and that was a factor for me. My partner was very supportive in focusing on ourselves in order to be better parents. We also had Mary in Mendota Heights call and say, I'm 61 and have 3 kids. In the process, I had miscarriages and a stillborn. I waited until 29 to have children after I got my master's degree. I sometimes, some of my kids are, sometimes having children is out of your control. This discussion is not new. I think that's also true. So I want to know a little bit more about what the thinking is around fertility rates going down and what factors are contributing to this? And what do we know about women who are choosing not to have children at all? Elise, what does the research tell us on that?
So I'm not that sure about what the research says on that. I think one thought I'd like to enter into this conversation, if
sure.
I might, is that some of this sort of detrimental idea of increasing inequality and some people who have more resources, and certainly the family discussed in that New York Times article was, you know, way on the rich end of the spectrum, being able to make those sort of investments compared to people who don't have those resources. Some of that would obviously not be quite so harsh differences in reality if we had better policy. I mentioned, you know, childcare policy. But also, it wouldn't be so difficult if we didn't have so much inequality in this country to start with. And so we heard from Megan earlier talking about working at a nursing home and wondering how she's going to be able to provide for her child. We know that working at nursing homes, those sort of caregiving jobs are disproportionately borne by women, disproportionately borne by Black and Hispanic women in this country, and those jobs don't pay very much, right? And those are jobs that we often, you know, think are really might value in society, just like jobs for childcare workers, teachers, right? There's lots of professions out there that are disproportionately borne by women and women of color that don't pay very well. So I think that to enable women across the education spectrum, across the income spectrum, to be able to provide for their children whenever they want to have kids, we need to make sure they also have access to good jobs. So I just wanted to add that into the conversation because these disparities don't have to exist so in such a shocking way, and perpetuating these inequalities with their children and achievement gaps and all of those things if they actually had access to better jobs in the first place.
Right, or jobs that pay a higher wage, right? So, and I think you guys have both brought up this really important point of childcare, which is expensive everywhere, but particularly expensive in Minnesota. You know, their most recent number I've seen is $16,000 a year on average for one child. And I actually know a number of moms who've stopped working because it made more financial sense to quit their job and stay home with their kids as opposed to continue to work and pay for childcare. Tell me a little bit more, Rhonda, about how you think this question of reasonable childcare costs or access to childcare generally factors into all of this.
Okay, so before I answer that question,
sure.
I want to answer your question about the research on women who don't have children.
Please, yeah.
I'm going to say probably there's that I've seen there's no research on that population. I think that, and that's problematic, i.e. because I am one of those, and I think if we go back to what Elise said about women providing care, we forget that for women who don't have children, we're probably providing a great deal of care for folks who have children. So Chris Marsh, who is a sociologist at the University of Maryland, has done some work on SALA, single and living alone, and in particular in the Black community. And I had her at a conference at Bennett College, probably 2011. And one of the things she said while she was there was, if you look at the Black community, the Black women who are middle class by her definition, which means you have an education, you make a reasonable amount of money. She has, I think it's a four-tier. So you have to own a house, be educated, make a certain amount of money. And I'm forgetting the fourth one, but that is her factor for you being a middle-class person. She finds that for Black families in the Black community, the Black women are a larger share of SALAs than for any other group. I suspect that also means that what we're also doing is carrying a very different burden than for other communities in terms of providing care because we don't have children, right? So we're a population that folks aren't having a conversation about. And I think if you're single and you're childless, we're not even on anyone's radar. Mm-hmm. It's one of the things that's incredibly frustrating for me during the political season, right? When we're doing election campaigns, the policies are geared towards families. They're not geared towards folks who are single, kids, people who are childless, and the thought of what we bring to society and what we need. So when I think about, you know, affordable childcare and this notion that there are a set of folks who can opt out because childcare is too expensive. Like, you look at, you're really just going to work to pay for childcare. So what would it mean for universal childcare? I think it's incredibly important for all women, right, to have affordable and quality childcare, because sometimes it's affordable, but it's not quality. And in terms of not only for you to feel that your child is safe, but also to provide you the freedom and flexibility to better yourself. So was it, again, Megan that called and talked about working at the nursing home? So imagine you're a mother in that situation. If you've got quality health care, I mean, child care and I guess health care too, you can explore going to college differently and maybe not wait till your child is actually a teenager where they could, you know, stay at home and take care of themselves. So I think the notion of quality child care is important, but sometimes I feel more passionate about this notion of finding out what's going on with single people. And even this conversation about when women are choosing to give birth, insinuates that that's what we are supposed to be doing, right? And from a, you know, and all of the conversation around feminism, I would love to see the choice not to be a mother be a real part of that, and not always I'm not a mother because I'm choosing my career, but I'm not a mother because maybe I just don't want
to be
that responsibility. That is for real. 24 hours till death do you part. You are always a parent. At 52, my mother and my stepdad will still ask me, where am I going? When am I coming home, right? And I'm like, geez, how old am I? Right? Because my mother is still my mother.
Yeah. I want to stay on this topic just a little bit longer. So I think what I hear you saying is that there is not much attention paid to women like yourself, and I'm in terms of research, and I'm wondering, why do you think that is? Why isn't anyone studying this particular part of the equation?
I think it's, again, it goes back to what I said, right? That the expectation as a woman is that you are going to be a mother, right? That's it. So if my expectation is that you're going to be a mother, why would I be studying single women?
Right.
Because the idea is that you're not going to be, you're single and motherless, right? I'm not going to study you because you're not going to be in that position for the rest of your life.
Right.
Or if there is a conversation, it is about, I chose not to have children because I couldn't figure out the balance. I remember when I was at Barnard College saying that to my students that I had elected not to have children, and they responded to me that I was selfish. And I can remember Oprah saying, you know, she elected not to have children because she just couldn't see having kids, being a good parent, and the things that she wanted to actually see, right? So it's, you know, one takes an incredible amount of time, and if you want to do both well, it is challenging, right? So for as much as we say women can have it all, this sort of conversation is suggesting you can't. If you're having a career, then you may not be able to have children. And if you want a career and you have children, you better either have a really supportive partner or you've got to have excellent child care. And if you've got excellent child care, then you have to make enough money to actually provide that.
Right. I think it sounds like we need to reframe what it means to be a woman in America, right? I mean, it seems like we're looking at it from one particular lens and we need to shift how we think about
that. I have been screaming that not just from the mother perspective, but also from the perspective that that woman should not mean white women, so that when we're having a conversation about research and policy and I read women, I see myself as a black woman in that. I see my godchild, who is Japanese and Chinese, someday who will be a grown woman, her mother who is Chinese, in that. My friends who are East Indian, in that. I don't see that. You know, so it's not just about women being defined in motherhood, but for a woman to be defined to include non-white women, right? Not you, Google women and you'll get back pictures of white women.
Right, right. Okay, so I want to take a call now from Sarah in Rochester. Sarah, tell us a little bit more about how you and your husband manage your days with your kids.
Hi, thank you. And I just want to thank you for taking my call. And I appreciate what that gal was just saying, because I was probably in the same boat before my husband and I kind of had an oopsie baby and had our first daughter. and balancing. I didn't know if I would ever have children either because of trying to balance it. And now I am a glorified server still after a 4-year degree because it's cheaper for us to just work opposite schedules. I work 4 or 5 nights a week as a server and he works during the day. And I find it so difficult for women to be in the position to even have children. We get told to go to school, get a 4-year degree, get a career, have a house, get some cars, and to be able to pay for all of those things, it's so unrealistic for so many people. And I can see where the struggle is real with the daycare situation. Honestly, I was just talking to a couple last night from Switzerland, and I was telling them about how expensive it is to have daycare here. And the woman, the mother she could not believe how much it costs for an infant to be watched for 1 week. It's kind of unheard of in some of those European countries for it to be that expensive. I think that for families, it'd be so beneficial for us if there was, I know it's hard because a lot of single people would be paying for it, but if parents and families, there was a subsidy for mothers who are staying home to take care of the children to have some kind of some kind of income to help supplement so we could stay home with our family.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about how that the emotional burden of being a mom or a parent who stays home with their kids is not, there's no price tag put on that. You know, there's no wage that's associated with that. And I really enjoyed this call because I feel like it touches on a lot of different factors here. And one of them has to do with some research that was also touched on in the New York Times article that women who are educated and high achieving are also finding the responsibilities of parenting to be far more than they expected and influences that decision to leave the workforce. Our caller in Rochester is still working, but it sounded from her call that maybe she's not working at the level at which she would be able to work with a 4-year degree. Elise, can you talk more, and you've already touched on this, but go a little bit deeper into this issue of women leaving the workforce or not working at their full capacity. What does that mean for our economy? What are the dangers there?
Well, in general, I mean, this is not just a problem for mothers. This is a problem for people across the country, people who, you know, have been in the labor market their whole lives, who want to be doing well, who have maybe gotten a 4-year degree, as you said, or maybe started school but couldn't afford it and had to leave, or maybe have a lot of debt. They're finding it very hard to make ends meet. And yes, the economy today is better than it was in the depths of the Great Recession. So we've seen improvements year after year, but people are still feeling it. And families who have two-parent families, it takes both people to be working pretty much full-time to be able to pay for their rent and their food and, you know, their transportation to work, their health care, all those different things before you even enter a child into the picture. So I think it's important to always take a step back with or without kids to just see how hard it is. And you hear these people one after one, you know, each one saying how hard it is to balance, but also just how hard it is to afford the basic necessities. And so I think that's important.
Right.
You also see is you hear women, I mean, you're getting more women calling in. You're hearing these mothers talk about how they're going to make the decision more likely to want to stay home. And some of that is rational decisions, you know, even outside of the cultural context, because women make less money on average. They're paid less. Even for the same jobs, they're paid less in this economy. And so if a couple is making a rational decision, a heterosexual couple making a rational decision to whether or not who's going to stay home, more often than not, it is going to be the mothers. More often than not, it's still going to be the mothers taking on more caregiving, even if they are working full time. So that's difficult. And then when you think about what that drag is on the economy of fewer people working, but also I think it's important to think about the drag in the economy of not devoting resources to those kids who maybe don't have those opportunities, whose families don't have the money, who were not paying for high quality, as Rhonda says, high quality and affordable child care for those kids. So you see vast differences in outcomes in just even in kindergarten by socioeconomic status. And so those untapped resources and the drag on the economy of the future is on the United States.
Right. So I want to talk a little bit about the wage gap here because I feel like it's an issue that's sort of lurking in the background with all of this. As I mentioned earlier, when I became a mom, I really wanted to feel pretty well established in my career. I wanted to know that I could come back and keep working essentially at the same level that I was before. But the reality is that I took 3 months off and I was exhausted when I came back. I mean, I don't think I was nearly as productive in those first few months after coming back. How much does choosing to have children contribute to that wage gap? I mean, is this the crux of the problem, or are there other factors at play, Elise? And then, Rhonda, I want to hear your thoughts on this as well.
Absolutely. It is a factor. It is not the only factor. If you got rid of the motherhood pay penalty, there would still be a sizable pay penalty between men and women. Men still occupy places in the economy disproportionately compared to women. As I mentioned earlier, women are more likely to be lower wage workers. They're more likely to be, you know, caregivers, child care providers, teachers, jobs that we have decided as the economy not to pay as well. So there is a sizable wage gap even among workers in the same occupation. You think about two people sitting in cubicles next to each other who have the same amount of experience, the same amount of education. Women, on average, are still paid less.
Yeah. And does that hold as well across racial lines, Rhonda, in your research?
Absolutely. And I don't even have much to add to what Elise said, except for, yes, I think the only thing that I would add is that we know that not only is there pay inequity across races, there is pay equity within gender, so that in general, Asian women make more money than other women. So we don't even have equality in pay within women across races, much less across genders. Right. And I think that's part of the conversation that we're not having. We continue to have this conversation, men, women, but we're not even, there's minimum conversation about the pay inequity within women.
Right. Right. What, tell me a little bit more about that. I mean, what does that look like?
So again, think about what Elise just said in terms of somebody sitting. We assume that the person in the other cubicle who is making more money is a male, but that person could easily be a woman who does not look like you, right? And you see this in Pay Equity Day, right? So when Pay Equity Day comes out, there's a day in which they say, here is Pay Equity Day for women. Well, if it's Pay Equity Day for women, the way I interpret that is, this is the day where all women would be paid a certain amount of money or what they make relative to the, again, white male. And Elise and I have been on Carrie on this show before talking about pay equity, where I've suggested that it should not be white males, it should be Asian males that we're benchmarking against because they make more money. But then you will find that later in the year, there will be the Pay Equity Day for Black women, and there's a Pay Equity Day for Native American women, and there's a Pay Equity Day for Hispanic women. Well, that right there lets us know that there is pay inequity between women because we don't have the same dates.
Right.
So why is Pay Equity Day women as opposed to, this is the day when white women, who are generally the majority of that group, and there's no conversation about Pay Equity Day for Asian women.
Right. Elise, jump in there.
Makes a great point. And just to clarify, add a little bit of detail to that, what she's saying, the day, it's the day into this year, let's say into 2018, that women, black women, Hispanic women, white women, depending on which day it is, how much they make the same as men did all of last year. So if how much men made in 2017, women had to work all of 2017 and then all the way to November in the case of Hispanic women to make the same a white man did in just 2017. So that's why those dates have the different meanings.
I see. Okay. I just wanted to point out one more point from some of the research here, which plays into this, which is there's sort of this 10-year window when it's not really a good idea for women to have kids when it comes to their pay. Women who have kids before 25 or after 35 seem to be able to close that gap, at least with their male spouse. But if you have kids within that window, it gets that much harder. Just really quickly, Elise, do you have any thoughts on what's happening there?
Sorry, I'm not that familiar with that.
Sure.
That exact,
Rhonda, and number. Any thoughts from you there?
I'm going to sort of piggyback with Elise and then go way back to my dissertation research. If you look at what earnings profiles economists would, you know, suggest that, you know, there's an increase so that it looks like a mountain, right?
Yeah.
And you can walk into a cave. So we thought about it, think about it as being concave. Those ages between 35 and 25 and 35, that's where folks are finding the most growth in terms of return to whatever educational investment that they've made.
Yeah, I'm sorry. We're gonna have to stop there. Our guests have been Elise Gould. She's a senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute, and Rhonda Von Shea Sharp. She's the founder and president of Wiser. This is NPR News.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.